Welcome. If you're a woman who has a sense that there's more out there for you, you're in the right place. I'm Whitney Baker, host of the Electric Ideas podcast. Somewhere along the line of work and kids, life carried on, but I lost track of my truth. I'm on a reflective journey, and that's what this podcast is all about. Each week, I interview a woman who is lighting her own path and offering others hope. Before our conversation ends, we'll share a reflective question for you to explore. Sometimes all we need is a jolt, a fresh idea, an aha moment that connects us to a sense of possibility. This, my friends, is what I call an electric idea.
Welcome back to Electric Ideas. Today's guest is Jessica Fine. Jessica wrote a book that we're going to talk about today called Breathtaking, a memoir of family, dreams, and broken genes. I just want to be upfront that while this conversation is largely about a heartbreaking topic, because the memoir covers Jessica's journey of learning about her daughter having a rare disease and ultimately losing her daughter in 2022, it still feels really hopeful. There were times when I was reading this book, Breathtaking, in preparation for our conversation, and I realized I was actually holding my breath. So while this topic is delicate and not something that's easy to discuss, I do think that sometimes in times of great adversity, we learn both human truths and truths about ourselves. And for Jessica, it was both. And I know this conversation will give you welcome perspective and probably encourage you to worry less about things that don't really matter in the long run. Beyond writing her book, Jessica is an essayist, advocate, and speaker. She also hosts the I Don't Know How You Do It podcast, which features people whose lives seem unimaginable, but who triumph over seemingly impossible challenges, just like she's doing. Jessica continues to contribute to many well-known news outlets, and she also balances all of her work with writing and podcasting with being a mother and a senior marketing executive at a global education company. I hope this episode gives you a chance to pause and reflect on what matters most to you right now in life, and hopefully give the people you love a little extra grace, maybe an extra squeeze today. Let's get into it. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
So one of the reviews that I read about your book called it a masterclass in how to be human. What do you have to say about living life with kind of a general kindness to others, knowing that we really have no idea what another woman is carrying on her shoulders?
Yeah, I love that question. And it's something that I think about all the time, because for me, that whole people don't know what's going on behind the scenes started pretty early on. So for example, I went through years of fertility treatments. And this was some time ago before people talked about this kind of thing as openly. And I was so private about it. At the time, it felt to me like the most personal thing that could be happening. Why in the world would I share this? And yet it was absolutely dominating my life, as I'm sure many of your listeners can relate to, because so many of us go through these kinds of treatments now. And I kept it all to myself. So I've learned over the years, and I've become much more comfortable. And obviously, I need to be comfortable now with a memoir coming out and putting it all out there. But back then, I was so private and I was carrying so much. And I realized looking back that other people had no idea what I was doing when I was, you know, dashing out of work to go to the clinic or taking injections in the restaurant bathroom or all those things that I was doing. And so that kind of was the first introduction to we have no idea what people are dealing with. But then as my life became even more complicated and less relatable, that stood out for me even more. So now I do try to appreciate, and I realize that most of how anybody reacts to anything is based on what they're going through. In fact, we often would tell our children as they were growing up, you know, when so-and-so was being mean or when, you know, whatever was happening, most of the time it has nothing to do with you. It's about them, right? So we just don't know what people are carrying.
The same things echo in my house. You know, when someone was mean or so, I always say, you just never know what's going on in their home right now. So that's sage wisdom. I couldn't agree more.
I read once about thinking about it as people are all carrying invisible backpacks and we have no idea what's in their backpack. We have no idea how heavy what it is they're carrying is. And so that visual really helped me.
Yeah. Your book shares encounters with unimaginable grief. And I mean, it includes the fertility treatment process that is very relatable for so many women and very difficult, but moves into the loss of various family members, including your daughter, Dahlia. And this is a lot to take in for many people. I'm wondering, just so that we can ground a little bit in your story, if you can tell us a little bit about Dahlia's story.
Absolutely. And thank you for asking that. I will talk about Dahlia as much as I can to anybody who will listen. So thank you. Dahlia was our middle child, and all three of our children were adopted from Guatemala. We knew very little about their history, their family of origin history. And when Dahlia was five, after a sometimes I think lengthy diagnostic odyssey, and sometimes I think it happened pretty quickly, she was diagnosed with an ultra-rare mitochondrial disease called Murph syndrome. So what that meant was that she had a disease that was degenerative, that nobody could really tell us the trajectory. And what happened was she was learning and losing at the same time. So as she was developing and learning to read, for example, and developing physically, she was also losing functionality. But we didn't really get thrown into an alternate universe until she was nine, when she caught a cold that became pneumonia and landed us in the hospital in intensive care for 3 months. And at that time, she lost a lot of functionality in a very short time. When we left the hospital, she had lost her ability to walk, to talk, to eat, to breathe without a ventilator. She had a tracheostomy, which for people who don't know is like a little hole in your neck that allows you to breathe through an alternate airway with a tube coming out of it. And she became what's called an eyes-on patient, meaning that myself or my husband or a nurse trained specifically in her care had to have our eyes on her 24/7, meaning I couldn't go to the bathroom if I was alone with her, or you know, somebody needed to be by her bedside at night while she was sleeping. And that really changed things for us, as you can imagine. My husband and I continued to work full time, and we pieced things together. And that was our life until she passed away at 17, 8 years later. So the disease continued to progress, and we were in a situation of saying, okay, totally having to change our mindset from we're going to beat this, we're going to cure this, we're going to find the light at the end of the tunnel, to we got to light this tunnel up and make it beautiful, because there is no light at the end of the tunnel. And how do you create that life for the kids, not only for Dahlia, but for her siblings too? And, you know, Dahlia was such a force. And even as she was losing all these things, she just wanted to be a kid. You know, she wanted to play and snuggle and have a life. And so she kind of presented that to us, and we stepped up and learned how to do that.
This is a very minor part in the book, but when she comes home from the hospital, and like you said, she'd lost her ability to communicate, she lost her ability to walk and obviously eat, and she really wants chips all of a sudden, I cried because I just pictured her motioning to you, and I can't imagine all of the things you didn't anticipate that would even be shifted for her.
Exactly, exactly. And we thought some of the bigger things, like the breathing with the ventilator. But as it turned out, eating was, I think, the thing she was angriest about, the loss of being able to eat. When you think about it, you realize, I mean, it's such a part of everything. It's such a part of community and culture, and how we bond together is over food. And the scene you're talking about is just a day or two after we've come home, and it's Mother's Day, and her cousin and a few family members are coming over. And we had said, okay, we're not doing any kind of sit down thing. I thought I had anticipated exactly where the triggers would be. You know, we're not going to do a sit down. There'll be food out and people can just kind of eat as they want. And there was a bowl of chips, and she wanted a chip. And it was when she realized, I think, that it wasn't only that she hadn't eaten, but that she couldn't eat anymore. And it was just absolutely heartbreaking. And she couldn't speak, but boy, could she make herself known at that point with the pointing and the mouthing. Ultimately, she lost her ability to move altogether. But that didn't happen until much, much later, until the very end. In those earlier years, she was able to communicate. She found ways and she wanted those chips. And so those kinds of, you know, it just everybody trying to kind of descend and figure out how to distract her and what we could do. And that was really tough.
During the time when, you know, you'd had this major shift with Dahlia, I also remember, there's so many heartbreaking pieces of this, obviously, but when you had a friend over to play with her and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, this just doesn't work. I have kids. I was picturing what you were describing of the friend kind of racing up and around and tell us about that.
That was so tough because her friends are getting like more physical and doing cartwheels and, you know, wanting to run around and look, check out all the toys. And her ability to move was so limited. And it was so heart-wrenching for us as we watched her friends doing all these things that she simply couldn't keep up with them anymore. And even though she was mainstreamed school still for some time, going to school with a private nurse, that was so tough. On the other hand, I'll never forget, we went to a school meeting, you know, whatever, an IEP meeting or something, and they were telling us what Dahlia's day looked like, and they were talking about recess. And of course, Dahlia was in the wheelchair and was limited in terms of how she could play on a playground. But they said to us, you know, what happens is all the girls run over to Dahlia and they'll say, what should we do? And Dahlia points. So she would point to the swing set or the slide or whatever. And then they would all go and do the thing that she said. So she even was kind of commanding what was happening in that setting. And that made us smile because even when our children don't have a host of challenges, you know, thinking about them on the playground with nobody to play with or nobody to sit with in the cafeteria, it makes us feel so horrible. And so I loved the idea of Dahlia directing what the kids were doing.
I loved her spirit. I mean, it just seemed like she was fun and spicy and sparkly is the word you use, even through it all. I think oftentimes when it's clear that families have something big happening, it's hard for people to know, especially people that aren't in your intimate circle, what to do or how to help. Was there anything anybody did that you felt was unexpectedly reassuring, helpful, or kind?
I love that question because I thought, you know, some people ask the opposite, right? Like, how did people surprise you by not showing up? And so it's a beautiful thing to think about and to be able to pass on and to learn from. And so I think the thing that was kindest for us was the people, and I'm thinking about one set of friends in particular, who continued to show up, to understand that we could no longer easily go out. That was a whole production for us to go out. And so friends who realized that and showed up and, you know, brought the dinner to our house and never got tired of that, never said, well, you live 45 minutes away. We used to meet in the middle, you know, and now they would just continue to be there. That was one thing. And to continue to show up and to invite us, even though we often had to say no, they didn't disappear. So I would say that is a big thing. I'd say another thing is people who actually took initiative to learn about Dahlia's disease, you know, because it was very tiring to have to explain all the time. And we had some friends who went and did the research by themselves. I will also say when we were in the hospital for the extended period of time, there were a few friends who showed up in that hospital every single day. And that meant the world. So I think mainly what you're hearing is this idea of showing up, just being there and realizing, you know what, the friendship's going to be lopsided. And that's just the fact of the matter and showing up anyway.
It's beautiful. In the book, I want to share a quote. You say, imagining the worst thing doesn't make you more prepared when it happens. How do you stay positive and hopeful just knowing such unimaginable things do happen?
You know, obviously, the book starts with the unexpected death of my sister when she was 30 and I was 27. And that opened my eyes to the whole idea that we do not know what's going to happen. I mean, she was my best friend and I was on the phone with her that morning. We were chit-chatting, you know, so it was just a very kind of normal conversation. And then she died suddenly that afternoon. And that really changed my worldview because I now understood that anything can happen at any time. So in that context, how do we stay hopeful? And I think that's such an important question, because I feel like hope is such an important thing to me, that it helps me move forward. It helps me to be in the present moment, but also be able to look to a future. So how do you hope when you're watching the decline right in front of you? And I think that for me, it was that what I hoped for changed. So somewhere along the way, I was no longer hoping for a cure. I knew that in Dahlia's lifetime, there wouldn't be a cure. So I was hoping that maybe she would sleep well that night, or maybe we'd have a great snuggle and read a story together, or maybe we'd be able to take her, you know, racing down the ramp in her wheelchair and play loud Taylor Swift music. And even when she could only move her shoulders, she was an awesome dancer, you know? So it was hoping that each day, really, and even within that, I mean, a day can be a really long time. So hoping that we were doing the best we could, hoping that we were giving some joy, some light, some love, which started from her. So much of the time we were following her lead, because she wasn't bitter and angry all the time. She wanted to be joyful. So we kind of had to do that. And I felt like I conducted that experience then. I became the conductor of creating that joyful life as much as I could. And not to sound Pollyanna, because it wasn't all glitter and sparkles and hope and love and light. There was a lot of that. But there was also intense anger and sadness and all the other things that you might imagine.
What's really coming through to me as you're talking about your shift in perspective of hope is almost looking at the very present moment, because that's all that was guaranteed for you.
Yeah.
And shifting into really dropping in to that more than worrying about the future. I think as a mother, we worry a lot. It comes with the territory. But as I read your story, I mentioned to you, we had a chance to connect. I happened to be reading this even on vacation, and I put the book down and went and swam in the ocean with my girls, because I was like, geez, I need to just show up in this moment. Yeah. I think it's really easy to worry about things that are ultimately pretty inconsequential, you know, drop in the bag in the entryway, whatever. What advice do you have for parents about keeping that perspective and maybe saving our worry for things that really matter?
Yeah. And I won't say that I've got it totally figured out. I will say that was a huge challenge for me, because I am most comfortable in fix-it mode. I'm really good at fixing things. And I think so many of us are, right? And, you know, with the lists and the, we're going to get this done and we're going to do this. And so I, you know, was determined to come up with this cure for this ultra rare disease that brilliant scientists and researchers and, you know, people with funds weren't able to cure. I was like, I will cure it. And there will, you know, because I was so comfortable in that we're going to get through this looking forward mode. And so it was a real, real shift for me. And I would say two things. Number one is this idea of letting go. We aren't in control. And there is actually a scene in the book where it's late one night and we're waiting for some of Dahlia's numbers to come back to let us know whether she was going into respiratory failure, which happened to her multiple times. And I was sitting with a young doctor and we were talking about, you know, what was happening right in front of us. And she said, Dahlia will let us know what she needs. And I remember thinking that was like a ludicrous thing to say. Like, Dahlia was totally on all kinds of medication. She wasn't able to speak at the time. You know what I mean? Dahlia's going to let us know what she needs. But she said, you know, if you listen closely and we watch, her body will tell us what she needs. And that was something that stuck with me and loosened my grip in a way that made me feel a great sense of relief, that it wasn't whether I was going to be able to decide if we should, you know, increase this med or take her to this doctor. Dahlia would tell us what she needs. And what's interesting is that piece of advice became really useful for me, not just with Dahlia, but for my other children, because I started looking at their behaviors as ways they were telling me what they needed. So when there were challenging behaviors, which we all have a lot of that, I started to look at those as what is this telling me? What does my kid need here? So that was one way that I was able to kind of loosen my grip a little bit on fixing and controlling. And then the other thing was watching my husband, who's always been better at being in the present than I am. And I would spend a lot of time looking for the studies, talking to the doctors, trying to fix things. And then sometimes I would catch him and watch him, and he'd be snuggled in bed with Dahl reading or doing whatever he was doing. That he was so present, and he's still better at that than I am. But some of that did rub off. And I think that because of my experiences and because of so much loss, I'm able to see that make the most of what you're in right now. And, you know, it's hard. I think perspective in hindsight, it's really easy to have perspective and to know what really matters. And it's hard when we're in it. I mean, it's hard for all of us. But I think being able to pause and think about the response and not just react, which, again, it's kind of a comfort zone for me, but being able to take that pause and being able to take that breath and think through how important really is this in the scheme of things. And that, by the way, is, you know, the name of the book is Breathtaking. And there's three reasons why I chose that title. But one of them is this transformation of learning to be more in the moment and take that breath. And then, of course, the other is that Dahlia's breath quite literally was taken away by the disease. And then just the beauty of Dahlia and the beauty that we tried to create our own little corner of beauty in the midst of this scary reality.
Yeah, I just want to reflect that piece about surrender back to you, because I feel like toward the end of the book, you were very aware that you'd shifted. You tell me if this doesn't feel right, but
yeah,
you'd almost shifted from this like busy, I've got this, I'm going to make the list, I'm going to call every doctor, your fixer mode. It felt to me like you had a great softening. And one of the lines that I really liked that you wrote was, there is great wisdom in knowing when surrendering is not defeat, but rather surrendering to the flow of life and letting it unfold.
And that was such a huge learning for me, because I thought surrender meant giving up. And there was no way I would give up on my child, right? Nobody would. So I would not surrender, right? Surrender was to say, oh, I guess this is okay. And surrender was to give up. I mean, that's what I thought. And then to realize again that it's not this like how tightly we can hold on and how much we can direct. And there's another scene in the book where my older sister becomes ill. And again, I jump in and I'm trying to talk her down one night when she's quite afraid. And she says, which she had every reason to be, she had stage 4 lung cancer, and she was really petrified. And I was trying to say, well, we're going to do this and we'll do that and we'll fix that, you know? And she said, Jess, don't try to fix this. Can you just sit with me in the sadness? And, you know, when you asked a few moments ago about what people can do and what's a kindness, sometimes it is just being there in the moment, in the sadness, in the whatever is coming up, in whatever the feelings are, right? And not doing the like trying to cheer up and trying to control.
What do you feel you wish more people understood about the different types of grief? I know you've talked about anticipatory grief and obviously the grief of losing a child. And I think that it might illuminate things for people a little bit to hear from you on this.
Yeah, thanks for asking, because this was such a huge learning for me. And I've, in the last couple of years, done a lot of learning and writing about grief in general. But one of the things that I learned is that there are a lot of different kinds of grief, right? I thought grief was what you went through and felt when someone died. Like, I call it Hallmark card grief. You can go to the store and you can buy a card. But there are so many other kinds of grief. And what happened was, I was asked at some point along the way to speak on a panel about ambiguous grief. And I said, sure, of course, because I always wanted to raise awareness. And I would always say yes. And I still will always say yes. And then I had to figure out what ambiguous grief was. Like, I never knew what that was as a thing. I had never heard the term before. And in fact, I had pride in myself that I wasn't going to grieve while my daughter was alive. I thought, how in the world can I grieve my daughter when I'm looking at her? That sound, felt horrible to me. But I really learned in preparation to speak about it that ambiguous grief, which is the grieving for somebody who is still alive, right? When there's no closure with death. So there can be a grief for somebody who's still alive, but they're not with you physically. Maybe they're a prisoner of war, for example. That's one kind of ambiguous grief. But there can also be somebody who's physically with you, but not with you in the same way cognitively that they used to be. That might be somebody who's suffering from dementia. That might be somebody who's got a drug addiction. And in our case, it was somebody who had a degenerative disease where she was losing cognition along with all the other functionality. And so it's this idea of grieving somebody who's still alive. And what naming it did was it gave me permission to feel it. Now I didn't feel guilty because I understood this is a real thing. And that's different from anticipatory grief, which so many of us go through as we're caring for elder parents, for example, where you know where it's headed and you're grieving ahead of time. You're trying to prepare yourself. That one is a little more clear cut, still different from quote unquote Hallmark card grief. But ambiguous grief, the name says it all. It's ambiguous. But with anything, when you can name the thing, it makes the thing lose some of its power over you. You can then begin to integrate it and move forward together.
That actually is really helpful because I didn't know the term ambiguous grief. I have a grandmother who is suffering with dementia. And even talking to my mother, I have asked her if she's grieving her because she doesn't any longer recognize us, but she's still with us. And that's a very tricky emotion to navigate. So I think just having that term, people can go kind of look it up and do their own research, but it's a thing.
It's a thing. And it's okay to feel it. So it just, like I said, it gave me such a feeling of permission because before that I was just resolute in this idea that I'm not going to grieve. I can't be grieving. I knew about grief, conventional grief from earlier losses, and this wasn't that. So what was it?
So it's very clear, you're so articulate, and this entire journey has actually, I guess, one teeny tiny silver lining is that the journey has helped you kind of reclaim parts of yourself that maybe you didn't realize you'd abandoned. So tell us about how your suffering in some ways has helped you step into your writing and your sense of self that you're enjoying, I hope, today.
Yeah, I am. I think that creativity has always been so core to who I am. And I was a writer way back when, and I published a book in my 20s, which was a long time ago. And I was a newspaper columnist and I wrote a lot. And then for anybody, we become so busy. And I took a job I was no longer creating. I was overseeing creatives and I was in a corporate environment and just became, for all moms or parents, we become so busy and there's so much noise around. And I was just doing everything whatever the next thing was that was right in front of me. But one of the things that happened was things slowed down when Dahlia became, as her disease progressed, things slowed down because, as I mentioned earlier, she was eyes on. And mitochondrial disease is an energy, a lack of energy, because your mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cells. So when you have a mitochondrial disease, imagine a battery, right? Like a battery on your phone. And imagine that at best, it's at the low battery and you often kind of need to recharge. All of which is to say, there was a lot of quiet time where I would be sitting at Dahlia's bedside. And it was actually there that I went back to writing. I mean, I guess it was actually in the intensive care unit. I started publishing pieces about what life was like in the intensive care unit. But in any event, at the same time, I had a lack of time because I had no time to myself and an abundance of time because, for example, if she was going to nap from 2 to 6, I was at her bedside. And for me, I mean, I read an enormous amount and that's my escape. But I also found that writing was a way to help me help me process, help me figure out what in the world was going on and help me take some control of the narrative as well.
Now that you're reclaiming your beautiful voice, are there any final pieces of life advice that you hope my audience can take away from today's conversation?
I think the thing is we can all do more than we think we can. And I don't mean do more like do more things to check off the list. I mean, we're capable of more than we think we are. There is no way in a million years I would have ever thought that I would be capable of essentially having an ICU in my house, of orchestrating so much care, becoming so highly skilled in medical care. I mean, it totally changed every single aspect of our life, emotional, physical, spiritual, practical, everything. I never would have thought I could do that, and I never would have signed up for it. So to be now on the other side and to see how we are all able, because maybe our situation isn't as extreme, but we're all faced with things we think, I could never. And you know what? You can. We all can, right? And so I think that's the takeaway, is we can do much more than we think we can, and we'll do whatever it takes when it's for the people we love.
So women in my community definitely are interested in really living fully in their lives. And so I always leave my listeners with a chance for reflection. So I'll ask you, what's one question women could be asking themselves more?
Oh, I love that. I think that a good question to ask oneself, or that we could be asking ourselves more, is how is this serving me? And I try and ask myself that when I find myself either reacting in a way that maybe out of proportion, or that's making me anxious or whatever, or if I'm going to do some work that is just not gratifying. I think that question can help us in so many aspects. How is this serving me? And maybe the answer is it's not, and you need to change course. Or maybe you really get to understand why being very anxious is serving you, or whatever the thing is. So I think asking ourselves that and checking in with ourselves on that on a regular basis.
Love that. I know people will want to check out your memoir, Breathtaking, a memoir of family, dreams, and broken genes, and find you and follow you. So where is the best place to connect?
Awesome. So first of all, also, I invite everybody to listen to my podcast, which is called I Don't Know How You Do It. So check that out. And of course, wherever you get your books, please get Breathtaking. And then check me out on my website, jessicafinestories.com. Jessica Fine, F like Frank, E-I-N, stories.com. And I have my latest writing and podcast. And I'm also really interested in speaking to book groups, speaking to organizations on any of these topics. So that's another way to connect with me.
It's so meaningful to have you here and hear your story. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for asking such insightful, beautiful questions.
I'm so glad you joined me today. If you're looking for more, feel free to connect with me on Instagram at @WhitneyWoman. And if you enjoyed the show, I invite you to support me by leaving a review or sharing it with a friend. Hope you have an inspired day.